Well, in one sense, the things I said last week, in a way, are more important than anything that I shall say today. But still, there is a matter of learning the trade, and getting your subject and making your point is part of the trade of being a speaker in any area of life, and not least, of course, in the things of the kingdom. Let's plunge straight in, then, to this problem of getting your subject. It's strange, in a sense, isn't it, that when we have the whole truth of the gospel and the unsearchable riches of Christ before us, quite unfathomable truths, yet we do find it difficult to get a subject to speak on. This is just a fact of experience. And I know nothing more agonizing than finding myself late on Saturday night or late on Monday night, not knowing what I'm going to be talking about the next day, and desperately searching around in books and in the Bible and in concordances for my subject. I hate living like that, and I imagine most of you have had that most uncomfortable experience. So I've listed six or seven ways in which I believe subjects come for speaking. First, through Bible study. And I suppose this is really the royal road, but the one that is most difficult because we are by nature lazy. Few of us do real Bible study. Indeed, were it not for having to give out, most of us wouldn't take in seriously. But steady Bible study, that is to say, a pattern of, I'm not talking about our morning time with the Lord, but 2 hours a week of steady Bible study, if you can make that a habit through life, and you'll always have plenty of material springing out into your notebooks. Now, very few of us, I'm afraid, do that. It doesn't sound much as a pattern, but it's quite a lot. The very fact that I had to study Colossians like a beaver to write this book on it means that I've got enough talks flowing for Colossians to last until 1987, and you get so bored with Colossians that I can't. But, you know, again and again, when I really got into what the verse meant, I thought to myself, what a wonderful Tuesday series. What a wonderful thing. This is just what the students are needing. But, of course, I wouldn't have got it if I hadn't done the hard work. In Bible study, it's important, of course, when we get these verses that spring out and we begin to see their meat, to be honest with the text and to let it tell its own story. I do press that upon you, just as the old golf pro tells you to let the club head do the work, whatever that means. I've never been able to discover in my own game. It is terribly important, if you're ever to be any good at proclaiming the good news of Christ, to let the Word of God do its own work. It has its own way of putting the truth uniquely. For example, I listened the other day on my tape thing to a tape on Rejoice in Your Hope from Romans 12:12. Now, it was the most excellent talk on rejoice. But it just wasn't a talk on rejoice in your hope. And it seems to me that that kind of exposition has great dangers, because if you give a talk on rejoice, you've given your talk on rejoice. You've got nothing more to say about it. The next time you talk on joy to your Sunday school class or your church or to your youth group, you'll say the same things, so that when you come onto the subject of joy, everybody knows what you're going to say. Whereas if you give a talk on rejoice in your hope, that is, if you let the text do its own work, you will find that it's a particular kind of rejoicing it has been talking about here, one that isn't often talked about, rejoicing in patience. And you will be fresh when you come to talk about rejoicing next time from another text where a different aspect of joy is put. Most important, this. Most people give you the same talk over and over again on forgiveness or salvation, whereas if they went to the scriptures, it would be always subtly different, perfectly adapted to a different situation. So from your Bible study, you will get a subject, if you do Bible study. Secondly, from a pattern of teaching. That's why the Anglican prayer book is so valuable, isn't it, to go through the church's year. That's why a catechism is so valuable. We very badly need, I think, in evangelical Christianity today, a new catechism that would be widely accepted amongst young people, that could be taught to young people. So that in the course of a year, a youth club leader could know that he was going to cover the ground. The same thing is done, of course, in every good Sunday school or Bible class series. I have my own private year for Tuesday services. I have a year of teaching. I always do man and sin and the world in which we live in the autumn. I always do Christ, the person of Christ, the atonement, if I can, in Christmas to Easter. And then I always do the resurrection, the Holy Spirit, and equipment for the Christian life, if possible, in the summer. Of course, that's interspersed with direct evangelistic series on Tuesday, but I know where I'm going on Tuesday, that I'm going to cover round man, Christ, and the Christian life every year on Tuesdays. It helps me, therefore, in my long-term preparation. At our executives' lunches in the livery halls, I can't possibly wake up on Thursday morning knowing that I've got to prepare a talk off the cuff. So I gave myself three words to take at our three lunches: reconciliation, redemption, resurrection. Now, each of those words is really simply an evangelistic talk, but each of them is different. Reconciliation brought out the thought that we were enemies of God, redemption, the price that has to be paid, and resurrection, the thought of the new life that God offers. So by just taking those three words, I've saved myself from repetition in these three executive lunches. Not that the listeners have the foggiest idea that I've done that, but supposing a man came twice, he won't hear me saying the same thing, although it'll be the same gospel, because I've got a pattern of three words. That's the second way I think you get your subjects, to give yourself a pattern of teaching. And if you're a leader of a youth club and you've got discussion groups and Bible classes under you, do give them a pattern so they know where they're going. Thirdly, subjects come, of course, from the needs of people and the needs of the hour. That's why I'm doing Law and Grace on Thursdays, because the house church movement frightens the wits out of me. I see the antinomianism that is rampant in evangelical Christianity today, and we've suffered from it greatly amongst the students, so naturally, I must deal with it on a Thursday. And so Law and Grace comes naturally. You read this booklet, and Not Under Law, written by some of the house church leaders, which is a miserable pamphlet, and yet people are reading it. Senior student in Thomas's Hospital believes it all, and yet he's an intelligent Christian. How can he? Well, because he's had no teaching. So we must have this subject. That subject chooses itself. Fourthly, you get your subject by being given it. You get an invitation. Please come speak on whether women should be in the ministry or wear hats in church or whatever it is. Well, then that's your subject, and if you feel you can tackle it, it'll introduce you to an entirely new area. I've been asked to speak on Romans 8 tomorrow night, and it's causing me a lot of work, but I'm grateful for the effort. Fifthly, if after all that you haven't got a subject for your Bible class or your youth group or whatever it is, don't look for a subject. Just take a gospel story or a psalm, some great passage or great theme, and explain it. I think this is a very important thing. People get themselves into the most awful tizzy looking for a subject on Saturday night. Well, don't look any longer. Open the gospels, take a famous story, and get down to it and explain it. It will do it its own work if you explain it and apply it and then sit down. People will be surprised what a good talk it was, because it had none of your oddities or special bees in your bonnet. You just gave them part of the Word of God. Sixth way of getting your subject is to repeat yourself. Wesley said he never really got his own sermon straight. He preached it 50 times or words to that effect. And it is foolish to suppose that we can't repeat material. I think it wise not to repeat necessarily the same talk, but to repeat blocks of material that you found useful. You can explain salvation or forgiveness in this way, right? Keep that block of material and use it again. Graft it into another talk. Re-illustrate it. Re-pray through it. And you'll find it is fresh again. Famous story of Thomas Chalmers, the great Scottish preacher, that he got tired of the celebrity seekers who came to his church simply to gape. So one morning after the sermon, he said that the evening sermon would be a repetition of the morning one, hoping to drive them all away. And the result was the church was more packed than ever. When you've given a talk three or four times, not only will you understand it, but the young people will understand it too. So don't be afraid to repeat, even though, of course, it should be hidden that this is just what they heard only a few weeks ago. And seventhly, pass on what you have heard from others. Don't be ashamed to do that. How can most of us be original thinkers? But don't, of course, simply plagiarize. Don't just take a Tuesday talk of mine and give it to your young people. Take the truth that was in it. Pray it through. Make it your own. Illustrate it for yourself. Find your own thrust. Rearrange it. And then it will be a genuine talk. I always remember the horror of one of the writers of the Church of England newspaper who went to Spree and went round all the great groups and found that all the speakers in Spree were giving not only the same talk but the same illustrations. And he wrote a blistering attack on the kind of teaching that Spree was producing, and I think in some ways he was justified. I think canned teaching of that kind isn't good enough. Fair enough that we need to teach what other people are teaching, but not their illustrations. It really must have come through us and be our own if we're to be men of integrity at all. But of course we pass on what we have heard and read and seen. It couldn't be otherwise. Now that's very simple, really. Perhaps almost over simple, but those are the seven ways in which I get my subjects. May I repeat them? Through Bible study. That's the royal road to getting subjects. And as you study the Bible and keep a notebook, perhaps, some other method of filing your stuff, just a very simple card file, put down texts and themes that you're beginning to understand for a pattern for youth club teaching and so on. Secondly, use patterns of teaching that you've got from the prayer book, the catechism. Robert Howes is going to do some of the 39 articles for us next year, and I think that kind of pattern of teaching is extremely valuable on a Sunday morning. Bible lesson book, whatever it may be, get a pattern. Indeed, every good youth group in a church ought, in the course of 3 years, to cover all the major doctrines. And therefore, it's very important for the leader to see what he's teaching, see if he's got at least some skeleton. Third, needs of people in the hour. Obviously, that will cause us to get some different subjects. Fourth, subjects that are given to us. Fifth, then look for a subject, take a passage from the Gospels and expound it. Sixth, repeat yourself when you've got truth together. Don't be frightened of repeating it. Seventhly, pass on what you've heard from others. So much for getting your subject. Not perhaps of primary importance, though perhaps of practical help to save you getting an mental breakdown at 11 o'clock on Saturday night when your wife is telling you to come to bed. Now, secondly, make your point. Making your point. Now, I've given three things. I want to give you three things here, which I think, if really followed, will always enable you to make your point. And how few talks really get there and make their point so that people grasp it and act on it. And I've got three headings, which may sound simple, but in fact are jolly difficult to do. Understand your message, shape your message, impart your message. First, understand your message. I was going to say in this, be lucid. I think it's too easy to say, be lucid. But of course, lucidity is really the heart of speaking. Really, if I said nothing else this evening, this is the very heart of it. You must be clear. And the only way to be clear to others is to be clear to yourself. Have something to say, and say it as clearly as you can. That is the only secret of style, said Matthew Arnold, and I think that's very good advice for any speaker. Have something to say, and say it as clearly as you can. Half the sermons have nothing to say that we hear. The other half that have something to say often say it unclearly. If you've got something to say, that's half the battle, and we have, thank God, for Christians, the best news in the world. If we can say it clearly, then you're nearly all the way there. Dense fog is in this part of London, wrote Dean Liddon to a friend, and it is attributed to the fact that Dr. Westcott has opened his study windows in Westminster. This rather unkind jibe, nevertheless, I think, shows what theologians can be like. If there is fog in what we say, it means there is fog in our minds. Very deep talk that we heard today, said somebody. Not deep, said the other person, just muddy. And often what seems to be a very deep talk is just muddy and foggy. It's that the speaker himself didn't understand it. And a great deal of radical theological claptrap is stuff, in fact, that you couldn't put simply. Professor Denny used to say, I've not the faintest interest in a theology that doesn't help us to evangelize. And I'm sure that's right. I want to go to so many people who speak on the wireless and theologically and say, would you explain that to me, supposing I was your daily cleaner? The answer is that often they couldn't. Can you put it in such a way that your daily cleaner can understand it? In that case, you'll have to understand it. To understand it means more hard work. In this Romans 8, I thought I understood Romans 8, verses 1 to 4, that I'm giving some of the students at City University tomorrow night. When I got to prepare my talk, I realized I didn't really understand verse 3 and 4, so I had to go back to it. And I had to read everything I got in my library, really, to see that I understood it. Now, at last, I think I've got it again. So the first point in making your point is to understand your own message. And to do this, you will need, obviously, to read and study and use such helps as you've got. And everybody who has to speak or lead Bible studies in any way will begin to build up a little library of his own. I take it that every one of you has done that or is doing it. You will have your own favorites. The New Bible Dictionary, for example, is a very good value. Because supposing you're tackling a difficult subject, sanctification or heaven or prayer, and you want to know all that the Bible has to say there, in about 2 pages you've got everything, really, that's in the scriptures about it. And you can get a balance there. You can get your context, and then you say to yourself, well, I'll tackle that side of it. I believe that every wise speaker builds up a library of good commentaries. There's no such thing as a one-volume commentary that is good everywhere. I still recommend the New Bible Commentary, really, just for its commentary on Isaiah. It's worth the value of the whole thing. Most of the others aren't worth it. But the Isaiah in the one-volume Bible Commentary Revised is worth buying the whole commentary for. Derek Kidner on Genesis, John Stott on Galatians, on the Bible's message for today. Very clear. Now, every speaker will gradually collect by picking the brains of his friends and his minister at home, if he's got a Bible preaching minister. He'll gradually collect on his shelves the things that are worth keeping. I sell to the students at a penny a time all the books in my library that I don't use each year, because I can't cart around great sack loads of books. So gradually I keep on my shelves only the things that I've found indispensable. And I suggest you do the same. Otherwise, again, there'll be a lot of dusting to do at home. Good notes. There's a chap called George, I can't remember his surname, who gets the most splendid Bible teaching in his assembly at home, and he gives me the notes. I keep them. They're awfully good. And so next time I come to speak on that book in the Bible, I shall look those notes up. They're worth keeping. It's worth, in other words, like a squirrel, storing away really good material. The first rule, then, is to understand your message. And this does require a lot of work, really. Not necessarily long, sustained work. Few of us have got the time for that. My own habit is to do a bit and then leave it overnight and come back for half an hour. Then come back in the afternoon for half an hour. Then come back the next day for half an hour. I find that my subconscious seems to have been working on it, and every time I come back, I see it more clearly, and at last the penny drops with me, and I try never to preach here on a Sunday or a Tuesday until the penny has dropped with me. If it's dropped with me, I feel it's likely to drop with other people. But if it doesn't drop with me, it won't drop with other people. I can't emphasize this too much. You don't have to be clever for the penny to drop. And if you understand what you want to say, it will come across clearly. Actually, this thinking clearly does sometimes mean a little bit of chiseling with your words. If you're really unclear as to what a verse means, well, then write it down in your own modern English and go on chiseling away at the sentence until you get it. We sometimes do that in our staff meeting. We try to get a sentence. What are we trying to do with Thermal Weekend? What are we trying to do with Tuesday? Let's try and put it in a sentence. I sometimes do that with a talk. What am I trying to do in a sentence? What is this really saying in a sentence? And then I feel I've understood it. So let's understand your message. Next, shape your message. Now, actually, this is really next week when I'm talking about any order is better than none, any arrangement is better than none. But I want to say something about the principle of shaping your message. Clearly, a whole heap of texts together is not a message from God. It's not a talk. Putting together everything I've got is not a talk. It's got to be shaped. It's got to be arranged. I take it that this is true in almost every walk of life. And usually, when I've done some study on a subject or a topic or a passage, I've got a whole heap of material. I've got then to knock it into shape. I've got to force it into some sort of form. Now, by shaping your message to get it across, it means, really, as the old country preacher says, I tell them what I'm going to say, then I tell them what I've said. Those 3 points are not bad. There is a sense in which the whole of a talk ought to be aiming in one direction. And so that leads you to ask the question when you're shaping your message, what is my aim? Now, that actually is a very challenging question. You're sitting in front of your Sunday school class, or rather you know you're going to be sitting in front of it on Sunday afternoon, so on Wednesday evening you get down to work. What is your aim? On Wednesday evening you're to be found surrounded by silver paper, cardboard, colours, every conceivable thing. And a friend says, what are you doing? Well, I'm doing the most gigantic Mickey Mouse or something, you see, and this is going to explain my lesson. What's your aim? I think actually if you search, you'll find that your aim is to keep their attention. Now, if your aim is to keep their attention and you make a giant Mickey Mouse, you will certainly succeed, but you won't teach them anything. So you've got to get past that stage. Of course your aim is to keep their attention, and that battle has got to be won. I do hope, by the way, it has been won in your Sunday school. It is painful to me how many Sunday schools are spoilt by one child that the Sunday school teacher won't push out because of some sentimental view that God is patient with everybody and therefore we must be patient with Billy. If your class is not getting attention, you can't teach anybody anything. So the sooner Billy is thrown out through the window, the better for everybody, including Billy. I mean this very seriously. You see, a great many people in giving a talk are simply aiming to see that at the end of it everybody has been quiet. Well, you'll get your aim, but you won't teach anything. Again, some people have the aim to give a good lesson or to teach sound theology. Well, you'll do your own aim. You'll give a beautiful lesson or you'll teach sound theology. But that's not surely your aim in a talk. You must think clearly, what am I trying to do? Well, let us say that the lesson is on prayer. Then your aim in that lesson is not to give a good lesson on prayer, but to see that the children pray. This sounds, doesn't it, absurdly simple, but you'll be surprised how hard it is actually to get your mind round that. Right. I want to get these people to pray. That will shape my message. So the passage set for that day is Luke 11. Let's quickly turn to it. He was praying in a certain place, and when he ceased, one of his disciples said to him, Lord, teach us to pray. Now, the lesson that comes out of that, isn't it, is that they were overwhelmed with the example of their master. As far as we can see, there is nothing else they ever asked him to teach them. They didn't ask him to teach them to do miracles or to preach sermons, but they did ask him to teach them to pray because they were amazed at his prayer life, amazed at its power, what it did for him and what it did for everybody else. An example that was overwhelmingly attractive. So in the end, they say, please teach us to do what you do. Right, well, now there's your first point. To pray, we need an example. Who's going to be an example? The children. Well, it's very unlikely that the children will have another child of their own age group who's sufficiently advanced in prayer to be an example to them. Right, that's out. So you can't say, look at Miranda. You wouldn't want to anyhow. You can't say, look at me, because they know very little about you. Though your prayer life ought to be an example. So probably the only thing there to do is to show, either in a Bible story or in a modern story about a Christian, which you read to them for 5 minutes, an example of prayer. And, of course, the obvious one in the Bible is Daniel. So you'll have to tell the story of Daniel if you want people to see an example of someone who prayed and whom God wonderfully answered. And unless young people see an example, they won't do anything about it, because young people go by examples. You've only got to look out of the window if you live near a green field or a garden to see a small boy kicking a football, and he'll be doing all the particular little bits and pieces, won't he, that his favourite footballer does. He copies him exactly. You'll see the little girl copying her mother exactly, and how she deals with her doll. That's how you learn. So how do you learn to pray? Well, there's got to be an example. So you've got to give them an example in your teaching. Again, what did Jesus do in verse 2? He gave them a pattern, so we better give them a pattern. The lesson might just as well stop now until they've got a pattern. Let's give them a pattern. Well, you know the old one, ACTS. It may take you 2 lessons to teach them that. By that time, you may have been left behind by the rest of the teachers. But you'll have taught them to pray. So you'll have given a good talk. That's how Jesus did it. That's how you got to do it. And then he reasoned with them in verse 5 onwards, and you may have to reason with them too. I'm going to come on to that in a minute. So shape your message according to what you want to do. Now, you may have one or two aims. You may want to attract the outsider who is not a Christian to listen to you. You may want to get across a particular point and so on. But shape your message according to the aim in view. Do try to have that aim. Understand your message, shape your message, and then the last point, impart your message. 2 Timothy chapter 4. Impart your message. That means get it into a person. I love 2 Timothy 4 because it shows how to get it in. Be urgent in season and out of season, verse 2. Convince, rebuke, and exhort. And I dare say you've noticed how those three are three different areas. Convince, what? The mind. Rebuke, what? The conscience. Exhort, what? The will. So that's how Paul went to work. He got it in by going at mind and conscience and will. By the way, he didn't go in just at the heart. There was no sentimentalism in his preaching. To go for people's feelings, to go to be a tearjerker, is to prostitute speaking, isn't it? We go for the mind, the conscience, and the will. That is that we go first to the mind, even with children. Simplicity is not shallowness. You're not to preach over people's heads, but do preach at their heads. Do you know that lovely story in Lloyd Jones's book on preaching, how when he was ill he got that letter from the two children? The girl, I think aged 12, wrote to him and said that she and her brother were longing for him to return to the pulpit. Because she said, "You're the only preacher we understand." If you know Dr. Lloyd Jones's sermons, you'll be amazed that a child of 12 could write that. But we quite underestimate the fact that people will think about what they're interested in. It doesn't mean being academic. It doesn't mean being foggy. It means getting a person's mind interested in what you're saying. And children have got minds to use. So you've got to get into a person's head and conscience and will. And sometimes that means speaking person to person. Sometimes when I've prepared very, very carefully on a Tuesday and I'm rolling through my talk, I've got probably too much to say, I'm conscious of the fact that I'm giving a talk, and I realize that people, I can see you. I can see Andrew over there just nodding off. So what I do is I consciously say, I am explaining this truth, and I think, what am I actually saying? And I start really to think it through as I'm speaking. And the moment I do that, his head comes up again. It's remarkable to see it. Because, you see, I wasn't actually speaking from my mind. I was just speaking from my notes. And as I was speaking from my notes and I got stewed up and we were going along, suddenly everybody stops listening. Because it's just a talk. So I have to get back into the notes again. It has to come from me. Then it'll go into you. That happened today, actually. I struck a point where people weren't listening, so I had to say, well, I better say what I really believe instead of just saying what's on the notes. Suddenly it's heart to heart again. And then, as we go to the will, we shall ask them actually to do something about it. At the end of the talk, there will be some application, at any rate, so that they have to do it. And it's only in doing what you say, in some measure, that the point will have been made. Otherwise, it's left up in the air. So you've got to press it in with a drawing pin at the end and invite some kind of response, either by way of discussion or action or what you will. Well, there are the three things, then, for making your point. They are very, I'm afraid, brief like that, but I hope they'll set you to work. Understand what you want to say. Shape your message to say it, and then impart it. Try to get it into a person's mind and heart and conscience and imagination, and this will need every kind, of course, of method of talk, from illustration to exhortation to teaching and so on. And we'll go on to that next week.